We are continuing our Nativity series, and we're now looking at Matthew chapter 2. Turn your Bibles over to Matthew chapter 2. We already covered Matthew chapter 1. If you missed those two studies on Matthew chapter 1, then you can listen to the archive. But for today, we're going to now look at Matthew chapter 2. Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, right off the bat, you're struck with a problem. If you've been reading along, or let's say you're a Christian listening in to this story in an early Christian church, or you've been reading this as a Jew in the first century, you're reading this, you hear, well, there's a contradiction. We've been listening to all sorts of references to the King of the Jews. His name is Jesus, right? So look at chapter 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus, the Christ, son of David, okay? That is the Christ, the anointed one. That's the Greek form, O Christos, from the Hebrew, HaMashiach, the anointed one, is a reference to the anointing of the king. So that's one of the titles of the king, the anointed one, the Messiah, the Christ, whatever language you want. If you go back and look at 1 Samuel chapter 10 and 1 Samuel chapter 16, you see the anointings of Saul and David. And in fact, in chapter 12, you hear about Saul being referred to by Samuel as the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah, again, whatever language you want. So it's a title for the king. It's synonymous in first century Judaism for king. If we had more time, we would go back and rehash all that. We already covered it in our previous studies. You can see the parallelism of that title the next time you get a title, Son of David. Again, title for the legitimate king based upon that promise in 2 Samuel 7. The only sons of David may sit on the throne in Jerusalem, at least legitimately. And then look, verse 6, Jesse, the father of David, the king. David the king, that son of David, that's a kingly reference we heard earlier. Okay, and then now, verse 16 of chapter 1. Jesus was born who is called the Christ. There's that framing device for the whole genealogy. He's the anointed king. Verse 18, now the birth of Jesus, the Christ. Again, if you're a Jew, you're hearing the king, the anointed king. This is it. And he's adopted in the house of David. Look at this. Joseph was the house of David. Joseph, son of David, there in verse 20. He will save his people from their sins, verse 21. That is language borrowed from or playoff of the references to the job description of the king in the Old Testament. He would save them from their enemies. All right, so that's quite enough here. You can see the whole chapter rings with references to the royalty, the kingship of Jesus. Okay, you can't avoid it. So as you're reading chapter 1, you're hearing this. This is what chapter 1 is all about. Jesus is the king. He's the long-awaited son of David, the king, the Messiah. He's the one we're waiting for. He's the king over and over and over and over. And then once he said all that, then he gives you these shocking words. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, right? So you go, oh yeah, that's right. He's born in Bethlehem, right? Bethlehem's the place where David came from. This is David's village. You know this from from 1 Samuel chapter 16. So he's come from the family of David. Everything fits. You probably also would know the prophecy from Micah if you were a Jew in the first century. So this is all fitting with this. And then he says, in the days of Herod the king. Okay, so you have a major contradiction, a major problem. Jesus is the king. Jesus is the line of David. Jesus is the one born of Bethlehem. Jesus is the Christ, over and over and over. And then now, but there's another king. Here's the historical context. There's a problem. There is another king ruling over the people of God, and he's in Jerusalem, and his name is Herod. Behold, at that time, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. All right, so historical context dating here. He's born during the reign of Herod. We know he's born toward the end of the reign because Herod's going to die shortly. So, but Herod reigned from 37 to 4 BC. 37 to 4 BC. And very shortly after this episode, Herod's going to die. So it is typical today, historians will usually place the birth of Jesus shortly before the death of Herod. So somewhere around maybe 5 BC, somewhere in there, maybe 6 BC, something like that. 5 BC, yeah, okay. All right. Verse 1. And wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying. So wise men from the east. Wise men. What's a wise? Now, translations vary here. You might have a different translation, whatever you have. The magos is the Greek word. Magos. From which we get our modern English word, magician. But Matthew doesn't mean magicians, okay? We're not talking about Las Vegas, you know, tricks and smoke and mirrors here. Magician. So though the word magician comes from this in modern English, this is not the meaning of it in Greek in the first century. A magos was a man who, an astronomer slash astrologer slash scientist. You remember Gilligan's Island? Do you remember the scientist, the doctor on Gilligan's Island? Okay, that's a magos. Okay, there's your magos of the first century. The guy just, anything having to do with anything with science, he knew. Okay, so I'm probably dating myself there. Is that TV show even on anymore? I don't know. But anyway, so a magos, he was a wise man. A man of the first century who knew the sciences, the sciences. So he knew botany, he knew pharmacology, he knew that he had read the ancient Greek science manuals, the medicine manuals, he knew the stars, he knew, okay, you get a picture here, we're talking about someone who is a general, in a modern English, scientist, I guess would be a good English translation here to get a sense of it. But you usually have a wise man, which is fine, perfectly fine here, but we don't mean philosopher. Wise man in English today, more of a sense of a philosopher, but this is not sophos or anything like that from the Greek. This is magos, so a scientist. He's an astronomer, astrologer, but without the, you know, the negative sense of it. Okay, so wise men, scientists, came from the east to Jerusalem. So the east. What's the east? Well, you have to put yourself in the context of the geography here, all right? So east of this location. Well, if you're in Bethlehem, in that whole area, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, obviously they're not coming from the area. They're coming from the east. Now, they don't mean the east like with a compass. The east with a compass would be to the Dead Sea, and beyond the Dead Sea is Moab, and then just desert. There's nothing out there. You have to think of the Fertile Crescent. From the east here is a reference to Mesopotamia. You have to go up and over the Fertile Crescent, okay, up into Mesopotamia, across the Euphrates, into Mesopotamia from the east. Okay, came from the east, from Mesopotamia, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Now, if you hadn't caught what I was pointing out to you before, right? You get the contradiction here, the tension. There's Herod the king, and these guys came looking for the king of the Jews. Well, there's some fighting words there. Herod is not a Jew. He can't be king of the Jews. That's his official title. That's what the Roman Empire uses to refer to Herod. Now, who's Herod? Herod was put on the throne. This is Herod the Great. Herod the Great, he was put on the throne, as I mentioned earlier, 37 BC by the Roman Empire to rule over the place. He is an Edomite. His father was an Edomite, a descendant of Esau. The Edomites were still around in the time. You go down, you think of the Dead Sea. You head to the southern tip of the Dead Sea. You're into Edom. Basically, if the Dead Sea were a clock, we're talking about basically 5 to 6 o'clock on the Dead Sea. That region is Edom, land of Esau. He's an Edomite. He's a local. He's from the region, but he's not an Israelite. Israelites are descendants of Israel, the brother of Esau. And you remember the tension all the way back to the time when they were born, right? So Herod, a descendant of Esau, is ruling over them. He's actually not just an Edomite. His father is an Edomite. So, you know, from an ethnic standpoint, he'd be considered an Edomite. His mother's an Ishmaelite. Father's an Edomite and his mother's an Ishmaelite. The Ishmaelites dwelt out there just beyond Moab and Ammon and Edom. They were out there nomadic people. And they had conquered Edom a long time before this, centuries earlier. And so there was a lot of Ishmaelites in Edom. Okay, so Herod the king, look at that. Herod the king. And again, if that didn't shock you when you heard that, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Uh-oh, there's a problem, right? There's some political tensions there. Now, it says, for we have seen his star in the east. His star, aster. In the Greek here, star, it's where we get our English word star. What was it? Well, I have no idea. But lots of people think they do. And some might, but I still don't. Okay, so there are lots of different theories out there. There are some great movies. Documentaries and things like that usually start popping up around this time of the year about astronomy and planet conjunctions and that period. And it's very possible it's something like that. I don't know. There was in 5 BC, and this is quite interesting, in 5 BC, there was a conjunction of Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. Now, that would be a pretty bright-looking thing in the sky. And if you ever spend any time looking up the sky, look at Venus. Right? Look at Venus in the evening, in the morning. Take a look at Venus on the horizon. That's a bright white star. If you combine Mars, which most of you probably have seen Mars, and Jupiter and Saturn together, that'd be something pretty bright. And it happened in 5 BC. So there are a lot of theories about that possibility and what it would have looked like from Mesopotamia and its location and all this stuff. There's some really fascinating ideas that have been proposed way beyond what we can do here. And I think highly speculative. It's very likely that's what it was. It's very possible that's what it was, but we really don't know. Some have suggested Halley's Comet, but Halley's Comet passed over in, I think it was 9 BC, so it'd be too early. Although it's possible that they saw, if it was Halley's Comet passing over in 9 BC, well, that would certainly give them some time to make it to the place, right? Start, you know, making some plans, some travel plans, and then eventually they make it to the location. So Halley's Comet, this was one of the, I think it's Origen. Some of the fathers suggested that, a comet. And then another theory was there was an angel. You find this among some of the early Christians too, that it was an angelic light. We do see the angels appear in Luke's gospel. So it could be an angelic appearance of some sort. It could be something beyond our understanding. Who knows? It really doesn't matter. In some way, God has provided for these magi, these wise men, the information they need, and one very important bit of information, is this bright light in the sky that a king of the Jews has been born, and a very important one that has been foretold in the stars. And I said to you at least one important bit of information there, because there's some other information they probably have. Why would they think that a star, a bright light appearing in the sky, had anything to do with a king of the little kingdom of Judah? I mean, couldn't it have been Egypt, maybe? A king of Egypt? A king of Babylon? A king of Persia? A king? Why Judah? Little Judah? Come on. So they've got something else. They have other information. It's not just a bright light appeared in the sky and they suddenly thought, I wonder if this means a king is born in Judah. They have some information connecting an appearance of a bright light with the birth of a Jewish king. And from that information, when they see the bright light, they now know that king has been born and they make their trip. Okay, so they have some information that somehow a bright star appearing in the sky is going to in some way foretell the birth of a king of Judah. Okay? We'll look at some of those examples in a second. So now, verse 3. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, the word troubled here, in a tumult, would be maybe a better English translation, a tumult, a stir, was in a stir. Herod was stirred, and all Jerusalem was stirred. That would be a better translation. Troubled in modern English sounds like the people in Jerusalem were worried. You know, troubled has that sense in modern English. But troubled, like we'd say, troubled waters, right? Stirred waters in older English. So in a tumult, in a stir, Herod was stirred up and all Jerusalem with him, right? Wow, what's this all about? Now, why is Herod stirred up? Well, Herod knows that he's not the legitimate king on the throne. He's been doing everything he can to make himself look like he's legit. He has a building project. He's been working on the temple. Why does he want to build the temple? Because the most important prophecy for the Jews is that the king who will come will be the fulfillment, first and foremost, of that great messianic prophecy of 2 Samuel 7, that the king would be of the line of David and he would build a house for the Lord. Well, Herod can do nothing about his line of David problem, right? But he can do something about building the house for the Lord. And this is why Herod and his sons then after him endlessly are working on the temple. It's a continuous building project. It's so overdone by the time Jesus and his disciples walk into the temple at the end of Jesus' ministry. The disciples say, wow, Lord, check it out. Look at all the pretty rocks. You remember this. And Jesus says, not one stone will be left upon another. Well, every time you walked into the temple, you'd see something new that Herod had done. Covered something in gold, torn something down and built it bigger. Right? So it's constantly in the mind of the people, Herod's the one building the house for the Lord. So therefore, maybe he is the long-awaited king, even though he's not of the house of David. Okay, so this is what he's doing there. So Herod, of course, is troubled. We know, if you want to read more about Herod, you can read Josephus. Josephus' description of Herod, he was very paranoid. He's a paranoid politician. Anyone who gave him any trouble, off with their head, including his own kids. On his deathbed, a day or two before he died, he killed, I think it was two of his sons and one of his wives. Just totally paranoid that they might try to take the throne before he was dead. Okay, so when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. You see how the word the Christ is used there? Where is the Christ to be born? Well, that's kind of a funny question, Herod. What's that have to do with the conversation? Everything, obviously. Look, the Christ is synonymous with the King of the Jews. You see how it works? Now, I keep emphasizing this. You have been in my Bible studies for a while. Okay, Father Sebastian, move on. We got the point. I know, but I can't move on because it is such a problem today among Christians who have no idea what the title Christ means. That it's synonymous for the first century Jews with king, the legitimate king, the anointed king. And you can see it right there. You can see that. Where is the King of the Jews? And then what does Herod ask? Where is the Christ to be born? You see that? All right, now, they told him, in Bethlehem, you Edomite. Okay, so Herod didn't know. Well, why wouldn't he know? Because he doesn't go to Sabbath school. He's not a Jew. He doesn't care about Jewish prophecies. He's a stinking pagan, okay? Herod does not worship the God of Israel. Herod's not a pious Jew waiting for the Messiah to appear. He's a polytheist. He worships many gods, and he's subservient to the polytheistic empire of Rome. So what the local Jews are wondering about in some, you know, ancient prophecies from Sabbath school, he had no concern whatsoever, except at this moment, right? Before this, no, who cares? But now, whoa, where did you say that? Could you guys go back and tell me what you were trying to tell me before? Where is this guy born? So they said, in Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet. This is the prophet Micah. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will govern my people Israel. So this is Micah. Micah is a prophet right around the time of Isaiah. This is long after the time of David. This is a prophecy about the rise of a king who will be born not in Jerusalem, like all the kings before were born since the time of David, but instead born in Bethlehem, like the first Davidic king. Okay, so you've got this very strong David connection here. When David conquered Jerusalem, in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And then in chapter 6, he makes it his capital. In chapter 7, he gets that great dynastic promise. Well, from that moment forward, all sons of David, at least those who were close enough within the royal family line, were all born in Jerusalem. All the way until the Babylonian exile, when the last king of the line of David, Zedekiah, saw his sons slain before him, and then his eyes were poked out as he was taken in chains off to Babylon. You can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 25. Okay, so the birth of a king in Bethlehem is unique among the kings of the line of David. It recalls the birth of the first great king of that line, David himself, okay? And, of course, we've already looked at the genealogy together, right? You can see all those David the king, all those David images. Joseph, son of David. There's that strong emphasis. All right, chapter 2 now, verse 7. Chapter 2, verse 7. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star appeared. Why does he care what time the star appeared? What does he want to know? He wants to know, assuming there's a correspondence, how old this kid is. Right? If the star appeared to these men over in Mesopotamia, say, year, 2 years. How long was it? I want to know how old this kid is. Is he going to take the throne from me? Can I sleep tonight? Or do I need to be ready? So he's worried about someone who might be trying to take his throne. How old is this kid? Right? When did the star appear? Is his question. And he sent them to Bethlehem. So he found out when the star appeared. When was it? As we're going to find out, it seems to have been about probably about a year ago, as we'll see in a second. He sent them to Bethlehem saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." Notice it's a child. So Herod's got some sense about the approximate age. This is not a baby. This is a child. Okay. Now I emphasize that, as I'll be emphasizing these next couple of points here, because a lot of times, because of manger scenes today, people, you know, here comes Christmas time. They pull out their decorations. They pull out the, you know, the pre-assembled tree. And then the box of nativity, you know, decorations, the manger scene. And then all of a sudden there's a little barn and the animals and Jesus is there, and that you put everything together, the wise men, and it's very pretty. Okay, well, that's really bad catechesis, and that's not the original intent of the manger scenes as they were developed in the West. They were supposed to be catechetical. As we're going to see, the wise men did not appear on the night Jesus was born, but rather appeared probably around a year later. Even in the West today, even though manger scenes today, even in churches, I still throw these all together, you hear about the appearance of the wise men on the Christmas day. No, that's celebrated in the West on Epiphany. Liturgically, it's even separated. Anyway, this is probably shocking to some people. I'm probably ruining their Christmas here. I've always thought of the wise men appearing with the shepherds, but sorry. Verse 8, and he sent them to Bethlehem. Now, where's Bethlehem? Bethlehem is south of Jerusalem, not far, okay, just a couple miles away. He sent them to Bethlehem. You can, on a high hill, you would be able to see at that time, so you can see it from the Mount of Olives. You can see Bethlehem, not far away, just a couple miles away, downhill, down south, south of Jerusalem. He sent them to Bethlehem saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." Now, worship there, you know, for us, we hear in there different meanings. For Herod, he doesn't mean, well, he at least doesn't in his own head mean he's going to worship this king as a god. But in the ancient world, you worshipped gods, you worshipped kings, kings were considered to be, you know, kind of semi-divine and, you know, a demigod. All right, so worship here, Matthew might be intending some sort of a double meaning for us, which he certainly is going to be showing us all along the way. And that is that while those in the crowd don't necessarily understand what they're seeing, and we on the outside are learning, we have some more information. John does this all the time in his Gospels. So worship, to worship the king, we as Christians could be hearing in there a reference to Jesus' divinity. And remember, Matthew is expecting Christians to be hearing this story, right? So there's very likely Matthew could be intending some sort of a double meaning there. All right, so now, verse 9. When they had heard the king, they went their way, and lo, the star which they had seen in the east. So back when they were in Mesopotamia, the star which they saw in the east went before them now. It went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. Notice it's not a baby again. It's a child. And this is long after the birth with the angels and the shepherds and all of that that we'll hear about in Luke's gospel. This is an episode that happens later. And also notice that it goes before them. Now, this could certainly be a conjunction of planets, but the fact that it appears again right in front of them and seems to direct them over Bethlehem has led many commentators to suggest that this could not be a conjunction of planets, but rather is some sort of a bright light, maybe angelic origin, a miraculous type of things, something beyond the conjunction of planets. Again, who knows? I think the conjunction of planets is quite fascinating, but there is certainly a debate. Verse 10. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. Notice child, also house. You're probably getting the point here now. We're not in a stable. Okay, the stable, that's Luke's gospel. Now, there's no contradiction between these two stories. We're talking about two completely different episodes, okay? Luke is telling us about the actual moment of the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. Matthew is telling us about an episode that happened, as far as we can discern as we keep reading, somewhere around a year later. Notice they're in a house now, okay? Wouldn't want to be hanging out in a barn for too long. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Now, again, there's that word worship. So, and this is a sense, this is the sense of the Greek here, worship. And it has that sense in Greek. So the Matthew's probably expecting us now to get that double meaning. They're not only honoring the king. They're not only saying, you know, we are your political subjects, or, hey, we'd like to pay taxes to you someday. There's something more going on here. And I think Matthew is trying to imply that, and we're going to see a hint at that in their gifts here in a second. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. All right, so let's unwrap these gifts here a bit. So they brought gifts, and the list where we hear are gold, frankincense, and myrrh. This is why we often, when we hear about the wise men in iconography, in statuary, in Christian artwork, you usually have three of them, right? Each one holding his own gift, which is perfectly fine. There could have been two. There could have been, we know there was more than one because it's plural in the text, but as far as the Magi go. But it could have been four, five, or six, or ten. Who knows? But three is fine. We'll stick with that it's kind of the common thing you get in Christian artwork. All right, so the gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. How many Magi there were doesn't really matter. Matthew doesn't tell us. What he does tell you, though, are the types of gifts that they bring. What is Matthew hoping we're going to hear in these words? Gold and frankincense and myrrh. Well, turn back with me. Hold your hand there, maybe, or put a marker for yourself there. Turn back to Isaiah 60. You know the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah is a pre-exilic prophet. He is prophesying primarily during the time of Ahaz and Hezekiah, a lot during the time of Hezekiah. He prophesies about the coming Babylonian conquest and exile. You hear about that in Isaiah chapter 39. In fact, Isaiah chapters 1 through 39 are pretty depressing. For the most part, it's all really bad news. Isaiah chapter 1 through 39, it just gets worse every chapter. Until you get to chapter 39, here's the worst news of all, that the king of Judah, his own sons, will someday go into exile. And the people and the wealth will go into exile to Babylon. So that's Isaiah chapter 39. But Isaiah doesn't leave on a bad note. As with most of the prophets, he then turns and gives them some good news. So in Isaiah chapter 40, you get those famous words that most people know, at least from Handel's Messiah, comfort, comfort my people. And then Isaiah begins to tell about restoration that will come after the exile. And for the most part, chapter 40 through chapter 66, the rest of the book of Isaiah, is pretty darn good news. And it just gets happier and happier as you go along. So by the time you get to chapter 60 now of Isaiah, you're coming to the climax of the happiness. And so with that joy and excitement of the restoration, all the things that are coming, as you read the second half of Isaiah, now you're coming to the end of the book, and here we are at chapter 60. And you can hear this kind of excitement that you get. This is characteristic of the tail end of Isaiah's prophecy. So Isaiah chapter 60. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. So the nation, the world, that will be covered in darkness. But the Lord will rise, and this is in all caps there in your English translations typically. That means this is from the Greek Kyrios, the circumlocution for the divine name there, Yahweh. Okay, so Yahweh, the God of Israel. But Yahweh will rise. God will rise upon you, and his glory will be seen upon you. You hear this language of light shining from above? And nations, look at this. Verse 3, and nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. So Isaiah talks about the restoration of Israel, the restoration of God's people, and in this case, Judah, the kingdom of Judah at this stage in Isaiah's historical context. It'll be like a bright light. When Judah is restored, it'll be as if it was a bright light, the glory of the Lord shining over God's people. So brightly that the nations that are around, that are in the darkness, will come to the light. And it says kings will come. Look at that, verse 3. He goes on, lift up your eyes round about and see. They all gather together. They come to you. Your sons shall come from far, and your daughters shall be carried in the arms. So that when this happens, that the Gentile nations will come, and they'll bring with them any exiles or diaspora that are anywhere. They'll bring them back home with them. They'll bring them back to Jerusalem. Then you shall see and be radiant, and your heart shall thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you. Young camels from Midian. So there's going to be trains of camels carrying wealth to Jerusalem. They shall bring gold and frankincense. You see that? They shall bring gold and frankincense, and shall proclaim the praise of Yahweh. That is, they will have converted. So why are they bringing their gold and frankincense? Well, he tells you, because they will be proclaiming the praise of the God of Judah, the God of Israel, Yahweh. Do you see that? They have converted. That's why they're bringing gold and frankincense. Gold is for the king. Frankincense is for the God. Right? So incense, now gold is for the gods and frankincense for the kings too, that kind of thing. But incense, historically in the Bible, if you look at it, it's for the incense is offered to God, goes up, right? It's like my prayer arises like incense, Psalm 140 or 141, depending on how you want to count them. And the gold, though, goes into the treasury, right? Goes into the treasury. So these nations will be coming to Jerusalem. They'll be gathering. They will be coming to God's people. And they'll be bringing their gold and their frankincense, praising Yahweh. That is, they will have converted. And they will be therefore honoring the King of Jerusalem, both the earthly and the divine, right? The gold and the frankincense. Remember, they're waiting for two kings. The Jews are waiting for two kings to return. The king, the heavenly king, and the divine king. Okay, so he goes on, he says, verse 8. Who are these that fly like a cloud and like doves to their windows? For the coastland shall wait for me, the ships of Tarshish. So Tarshish, Spain, ancient Spain. So they'll be coming from a distant land, bringing gold, to bring your sons from afar, their silver and gold with them. This should remind you of the story of Solomon and his great wealth, if you've read about it in 1 Kings chapter 10. And again, look at this, verse 11. Your gates shall be open continually. Day and night they shall not be shut, that men may bring to you the wealth of the nations with their kings led in procession. For the nations and kingdoms that will not serve you shall perish. Verse 19. The sun shall be no more, your light by day, nor for brightness shall be the moon, your light to you by night. But the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun shall no more go down, nor your moon withdraw itself, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning shall be ended. If you ever read the end of the book of Revelation, it refers to this passage, right? Very beautiful. Revelation chapter 21 and 22 and et cetera. All right. So the image here of Isaiah is that when the kingdom is restored, it will be this glorious bright light, and the nations will come. And they'll be led, the nations will be led by their kings, right? The kings will be leading in procession their nations in conversion to the God of Israel. Now, if you know anything about the next couple centuries of history, you know that this is what actually happens. But this is also why we hear about in the song, the popular song today in the West, we three kings, right? We three kings. Because the wise men then are seen in that hymn, are being seen as the beginning, the very first stage of the fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 60. Whoever wrote that song apparently was expecting his audience who would be singing it to actually know the parallels. But today, tragically, most people don't read Isaiah. All right, so now, back to Matthew, chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2, verse 11. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute, Matthew. You've added something that's not there. You ruined the whole thing, Matthew. It was really nice, but myrrh. Now, it doesn't have actually the shocking effect that it would have had for a first century Jewish audience. For us, myrrh. Okay, myrrh. What's myrrh? I don't know. Well, so, but it's one of the gifts, I guess. Okay, so myrrh. Go look at John 19. Myrrh is for the dead. That's what they used to bury Jesus with, myrrh. Myrrh is a very strong smell. It's just like frankincense. It's a sap, and then you burn it, and you use it for incense. Now, frankincense has a very nice, sweet smell. Beautiful. Myrrh, I've outlawed it in my parish, except for Holy Friday when we go outside on processions. When we go outside in procession outside the church, when we do our Holy Friday procession. That's when the servers in the holy place, that's when they could pull out the myrrh, okay? It's appropriate on that day, and also you don't want it in the church. It's very strong smell, very pungent, very strong, takes over. So myrrh is for the dead. That's what they used it for. The only thing you'd use myrrh for, and for any other things, but primarily it's just something to cover up bad smells. So myrrh was used when you lathered a dead body. You anointed a body with myrrh and also nice smelling stuff like nard because it covered up the smell of death. And again, you can read in John 19 how they actually did this, right? They used myrrh. Myrrh is for the dead. So Matthew's doing something here for you. Myrrh. So at the very moment when he's telling you about the gold and frankincense, and you know Isaiah 60, and you're thinking, therefore, this is the divine king. He's not just the human king. He's not just the earthly king. He's not just of the line of David. That means this is the long-awaited, the divine king. This is God being born among them. And of course, we know, the story. But the moment when you're excited with that information, thinking of Isaiah 60 with the gold and the frankincense, he reminds you of something that's coming. Right? Though he is immortal, though he is the immortal God, the king of the universe, he will die like a man. But at the same time when he reminds you of that, your mind goes back to Isaiah 60. And as you read those first verses of Isaiah 60, you noticed, arise, 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 like a staccato throughout that first half of the chapter, all about rising up, arise, so that you can hear this symphony. You in the symphony of references, you can hear the entire gospel story that's coming. Now I know you might say, I'm hearing what you're saying, but I don't. Is it possible someone in the first century could have really grasped that? Oh, yeah. And we'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so verse 13. So they departed on another way, verse 12. Verse 13. Now, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there till I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt have I called my son. So this is from the prophet Hoshea, right? This is a reference to the Exodus. So this going down to Egypt in some ways is a precursor to Jesus coming out of Egypt, which in some way will be the fulfillment of the Exodus. Of the Son of God, that is Israel, Exodus chapter 4, Israel is the Son of God. Now, Jesus is the new Israel, and we'll talk more about that later on. There's a lot wrapped up in that imagery. But just to make sure you're along the way gathering the wealth of the text, Joseph, do you know any other Josephs who had dreams who saved the people of Israel by heading down to Egypt, right? So Joseph went down to Egypt and then brought Israel, his father, and all the stuff down to Egypt with him later on to save them from death. You remember that? From the famine. And so Joseph leads Israel, the new Israel, down into Egypt, right? And then this is going to be preparing for Israel coming out of Egypt and the new Exodus. More on that later. There's a lot here in that Joseph imagery, and we'll talk about it again another time. All right, now it says, verse 16, then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, was in a furious rage. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem, in all that region, who were 2 years old or under, according to the time which he had ascertained from the wise men. Do you remember that? That time he had ascertained from the wise men. So look up there in verse 7. And he ascertained from what time the star had appeared. So he's gathered a bit of information. He's guessing if the star appeared at a certain time, the child probably was born around that time. And so he now kills all of the children who are 2 years old, male, in Bethlehem and the region. Well, where does he think the child is? Bethlehem. But he also goes for the whole region, right around Bethlehem, the neighborhoods around it. And he outlined houses and things like that. Why? Well, because he wants to make sure he needs a buffer zone. He wants to make sure he doesn't miss the kid. If this guy's going to be possibly a contender for the throne, it'd be very difficult for Herod to defeat him politically, right? So Herod has all the... He knows he's a boy. He knows he's under 2 years old. But the fact that he knows he's in Bethlehem, but he goes for the region around as well, suggests probably that he thinks that the child is significantly less than 2 years, right? If he thought that the child was 2 years old, possibly, then he would go for 3 years old and below. So based upon the fact that he has all the boys killed who were 2 years old and below, seems to indicate that he's ascertained that Jesus is probably somewhere around a year old, which would make sense. These wise men from Mesopotamia, these men who have been watching the stars and have some extra information we're going to get to in a second here, have eventually gotten ready. They've made their trip. They've collected their frankincense, their gold, whatever they're going to do. And they eventually make their trip over the Fertile Crescent. This is before jetliners, okay, on their camel or by foot or whatever. They've made it slowly over the Fertile Crescent and made their way down finally into the region. So Jesus is, as far as we discern, again, notice he's referred to as a child. They're in the house, not a stable. It's not a baby. And again, from Herod's killing of the two-year-old boys, we can guess Jesus is probably about a year old. Verse 17, then was fulfilled what was spoken of by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Ramah is not far from Jerusalem. This is the place where Rachel was buried, near there. Wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they were no more. This is from Jeremiah's prophecy. Remember, the Ramah was the place where they assembled the captives right after the Babylonian attack and destruction of Jerusalem, 587. Anyone who was alive, they captured alive, like Zedekiah, they took them to Ramah, and then from Ramah, they, in chains, marched them to Babylon in the reverse, basically, path, the reverse path of what these wise men have done. You can read about that in Ramah and that assembly of the captives in Jeremiah chapter 40, if you're interested in that. Okay, so now, before we get on too far here, what is Herod doing? He hears about some child that's probably about a year old, and he just goes, to use modern terminology, ballistic. I mean, it's a little overdone, isn't it? He takes his forces down to the little village of Bethlehem. It's a little village, not far from Jerusalem. And he has them wipe out all the little boys. This is not the smartest political move, especially if the local people don't like you. Can you imagine? What Herod, from what we know in Josephus, was not the most rational politician. He was crazy. He was certified crazy. He was paranoid. And you can read about this in Josephus. What Herod just did fits perfectly in the caricature of what we know about this man from other sources. Okay, so this is not a surprise by any means. But still, I think it seems a little overdone. I mean, I would maybe, you know, maybe you'd send a soldier or two down to Bethlehem, kind of maybe trail the Magi, maybe go knock on some doors. I mean, it's not like there's any rush here. Okay, the kid's not going to grab a sword and kill Herod in the next couple weeks. There's no rush. Just go down there, find out where he is, and maybe, hey, bring the kid to Jerusalem. I'd like to sit on my throne. I'd like to talk to him a little bit, huh? You know, could you imagine how easily and quietly Herod could have done this? But that's not Herod's way. Herod is not rational. This fits perfectly into Herod's caricature as we get him in Josephus. But there's something more going on here. Herod's not simply crazy and paranoid. He probably has some more information that we ourselves often are missing. And that is the same information that these wise men have. They saw a bright light. How in the world did they end up in this spot? They could have gone anywhere, okay? So a star appeared, what does that mean? They clearly have some association of the appearance of a bright light with the birth of a king. Turn with me over to the book of Numbers. Numbers is in your Old Testament. You're going to go way back in your Old Testament into the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. Okay, and you're going to come to Genesis and then Exodus, Leviticus, and you're going to find your book Numbers. Numbers is the story about the wandering in the wilderness, the 40 years wandering in the wilderness. In fact, that's what it's called in Hebrew, the wilderness. It's the name of the book. The Numbers, the book of Numbers. And it, in chapter, this is in chapter 23. Well, for context, you could go back if you're doing a little Bible study, or chapter 22. I'll summarize this for you. Chapter 22 through 24 is our main focus here. The Israelites have come out of Egypt. They've gone to Mount Sinai. They've wandered in the wilderness for 40 years due to some problems. And then they end up now heading into the Promised Land. And they come up around the east side of the Dead Sea, and they're going to cross over the Jordan right across from Jericho. This is the spot where Jesus was baptized. More on that later. Before they cross over the Jordan, and they're encamped in the plains of Moab, just opposite Jericho, on the other side of the Jordan River there, the Moabites and the Midianites start to tremble. They know that anybody who tries to withstand this nation, who gets in their way, is mowed down. But what's strange about them is that they don't seem to have a king among them. In the ancient world, when you attacked another nation in this region, the king was on the front and center of the battle line. Okay, he had the biggest chariot and the biggest sword, and he was the biggest soldier. So can you imagine when the kings of the region, and you hear the stories about them earlier in Numbers, try to stop Israel from passing through their land? They come out with all their chariots, and there's Israel standing there. No chariots. These aren't soldiers. And there's no king on the front line. But somehow, they're routed by the Israelites. So there's this strange mystery. They seem to, it's like as if they've got a king, but no one can see it. Okay, so now, in chapter 22, the Moabites, the Midianites, the rest, they say, look, we're going to need some help here. In order to defeat these people, we're going to have to call in some divine forces. So they call a prophet from the east, from beyond the Euphrates. His name is Balaam. This is in chapter 22, verse 5, from beyond the river. Okay, so this is the Euphrates, the river. He's met from Mesopotamia. And he's a prophet. In the ancient world, it was believed that if a prophet said something, that the God would have to act. The God that he is a prophet of. So they bring in this famous prophet. He's a pagan prophet. And these are pagans. So they hire this guy. They bring him over. He's got a great reputation, a great CV. And so they bring him over and they say, look, we're going to give you a bunch of gold. And all you got to do is curse the people of Israel. Well, who are these? Oh, they're down there. You see them down there? So they're up on the mountains of Moab. And they're looking down at the encampment of Israel down in the plain. And he's, okay, I can, all right, fine. All right, so where are we going to do it? So they give him a nice mountain peak. And they offer some sacrifices to the gods. And they say, okay, Balaam, give us a real good curse, all right? And once you curse these people, we're going to go down to our chariots and we're going to attack. Okay. Well, he opens his mouth, and instead of cursing them, he blesses them. This is in chapter 23, verse 7. Verse 7 through 10. And instead of just a curse, you get this beautiful poetic blessing. Well, verse 11, his employer is not very happy. And he says, look, you're not, I told you to curse them, you blessed them. And remember, they thought that if the prophet were to say something, it had to happen. So then he says, look, let me take you to another mountain. Maybe we've got you, you know, this isn't a good mountain for you. So he takes him to another mountain peak and they do the same thing. And this in chapter 23, verse 18, Balaam opens his mouth and now gives a longer blessing instead of a curse. And in fact, look what he says in verse 21, he has not beheld misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. Yahweh, the Lord, their God, is with them. The shout of a king is among them. So he just identifies that the king of this nation these people are going to try and fight is a god. Okay, now you don't want to hear that if you're the king that's going to have to go against a god on the front line in a battle, okay? Kings go against kings, they don't go against a god. So then his employer, again, verse 25, is not very happy with him. And then he says, look, let's try another hillside. So chapter 24, he takes him to another spot. And look at verse 3. Instead of a curse, every blessing gets longer. And look what he says in verse 7. His king shall be higher than Agag. His kingdom shall be exalted. Agag was a famous king in the region. Verse 9, he couched, he lay down like a lion, and like a lioness who aroused him up. Blessed be everyone who blesses you, and cursed be everyone who curses you. So you're hearing there Genesis 12:3. You're also hearing Genesis 49:9, the reference to Judah as the royal line, the scepter shall not pass from Judah. So now what you've got here are two different prophecies, or you have prophecies about a king, but one seems to indicate that the king is their God, and the other one seems to be a reference back to Genesis that their king will be coming from Judah. Well, how can they have both? Okay, so then, again, his employer is not very happy, chapter 24, verse 10, tries to fire him, and while he's trying to fire him and tell him to go back home without any pay, Balaam says, I have one more thing to say. No, please. And he opens his mouth and he gives another prophecy. And this is in chapter 24, verse 15. And look what he says. The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down, but having his eyes uncovered. Verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. So he sees the rise of a star as an image of the rise of a king. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. Verse 18, Edom shall be dispossessed. Now you might have a hint at why Herod's a little nervous. Not only do they have a prophecy that their king is going to come from Micah, from Bethlehem, as Micah said. But when he appears, this mighty king, it'll be like a star rising. And at that moment, Edom will be dispossessed. Herod the Edomite is certainly nervous. Okay? Now, how in the world could these wise men have gotten this information? Well, you have to fast forward back to Isaiah. Back to Isaiah chapter 39. Back to the story of 2 Kings chapters 23 and 24 and 25. You remember that the Jews went into exile in Babylon, and that Daniel and his three friends were brought into the court. In the ancient world, when you conquered a people, you took their craftsmen, their wise men, everything they had, their wealth, which was not only material but also immaterial, their knowledge, their scrolls, anything they had came in to your palace, and you then acquired their material and immaterial wealth. Again, you know the story of Daniel and the three friends, right, in the book of Daniel. So the scrolls of the five books of Moses, the scrolls would have been brought with them to Babylon, and the Babylonians would have had the Torah. And so in Babylon, in Persia, in Assyria, in this region, all the way up until this present moment, the time we're in first century BC, into this era, the first century, you have now the prophetic guild, or the guilds of these court prophets and wise men, have been handing this information down in Mesopotamia for centuries. Now, I ask you one final question, we'll end here. How could Matthew have expected his audience to pick this up? How could Matthew expect Jews in the first century, Christian Jews in the first century, to understand any of what we're talking about right now? Well, I'll tell you why. Because if you went into the living room of a Jewish family in the first century, you would not have found a big box plugged into the wall with flashing lights. or a big thing bolted to the wall now. Again, I'm dating myself here. Okay, you would not have found TV. What you would have found was rather in the evening, as the family was getting ready for bed, Mom would have been singing the Psalms to the kids as she put them to sleep. And if they asked for a bedtime story, they would have gotten one, like the story of Israel traveling in the wilderness, like the story of David the king, like the story or the prophecies that we find in Isaiah. These are the stories that the first century Jews knew, like the back of their hand. There was no Sesame Street. There was no electric company. There was no MTV, CNN. There was no bad news. There was only the good news. And hopefully today we Christians could begin to meditate upon that good news a little more often as we prepare for the celebration of the birth of the King. To Jesus Christ be glory with his eternal Father, his all holy good and life-giving spirit, both now and ever and into age of ages. Amen.